¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
All right. Today I'm doing something a little bit differently. I am doing a solo episode. And for those of you that don't know me, my name is Holly Meyer Lucas, and I started this In the Hype Seat podcast. And I've been told for years and years and years that I need to have a podcast. I've been a guest on many people's podcasts, and I love doing them. I love coaching. I love mentoring. If my story helps one person with theirs, then that's the name of the game with my entire life. But for whatever reason, I've really struggled to tell my own story my own way. Like I always, whenever I'm on someone else's podcast, them asking me the questions and them driving the conversation, I had to take those headphones off. I feel like I was echoing myself. And I say it like that because like one of the things that I'm known for is my confidence and self-esteem and the ability to make bold, big decisions and bold, big moves. But I'm not that comfortable talking about myself kind of unsolicited. Like the anxiety that I have over people thinking that me sitting here talking about myself is going to come across as arrogant. But like I said, for years I've been told backwards, forward, sideways that I need to share my story. So this is me sharing my story. Here's what's interesting. When I asked ChatGPT to give me some questions to ask myself, the very first question that it came up with is, when did everything change for you? And it put in parentheses, a pivot, a meltdown, a breakthrough. And like that question gives me so much material as a jumping off point, because my gut reaction to that is, you know, it's a broad question. Like, when did everything change for you? Like if I asked you that question when you're listening to this, if I asked you, when did everything change for you? You might want to ask back in return, like, well, what do you mean? Like what change in terms of what? And for me, reading that question just now, you know, this is 2025, recently launched several businesses that I had been wanting to and plotting and trying to figure out how to launch for years and years and years. Arguably one of them, my entire life, I've been wanting to do this and I finally have in a big way. So that question, when did everything change for you? My entire life has been like a pivot party. I feel like all that I've done my entire life is pivot off of, you know, certain situations and certain things that have happened and whatnot. Reading ChatGPT come up with that question, it kind of stopped me in my tracks just now as like, oh yeah, that's what I'm going to talk about. Like that's what this episode is going to be about. It's going to be about when everything changed. And in order for me to do right by that, I really need to go back to how things led up to. So I'm going to do that first. And then I'm going to talk about how things change for me. I'm going to tell this in a way that is, if you don't know me, like I'm going to tell this cold. And so forgive the like duplicate stories that I'm about to tell, but I need to do right by this. And it's my podcast and I'll do what I want. So going back, a couple housekeeping things here. I was born in Seattle, Washington. My mom's American. My dad's German. When I was in third grade, we moved to Germany and my dad had lost his business. He owned a travel agency. And so he lost his business, forcing him to relocate us. I have three siblings. So there are four of us to Germany. And the reason that that's relevant is because I know deeply in my soul what it's like to not only be the new kid, but also to be in an environment where not only did I not speak the language and had to go to school and like basically wear the fact that I was like the weirdo new kid, but I know what it's like to face adversity from like a very, very early age. Like experiencing my parents declaring bankruptcy when I was 9 years old the first time was weird and hard, and like going from, you know, living in a big, beautiful house to moving to Germany and living in a like row house apartment style where all four of us kids shared one bedroom was formative, if that makes sense. Anyway, we moved back to the States when I was in high school. I went to 5 different high schools. I was the new kid 5 different times in high school. And then I went to college to play soccer and became NCAA ineligible when I transferred. In college, my parents lost their house during the recession. My parents have had 2 bankruptcies that have been in like two kind of like critical times of my upbringing, which really, really shaped my ability to lead and run my businesses. Seeing them go through that once in the 90s, when basically when the internet collapsed, the travel agency industry, when my dad lost his first business, and then in the recession, when he was laid off and they lost their house, that those moments were really, really pivotal in my life and in understanding just what it's like to have $0 in your bank account. And I talk about this fairly often. It's never, ever, ever lost on me. The person that I was, especially in college when I put myself through school, I was completely on my own in terms of, you know, paying for my phone and insurance and everything, car, literally everything financially. And so I have always been a workhorse because of that. Like I am deeply, deeply terrified of losing it all and of making a bad financial decision. And that's just kind of something that is really ingrained in my, like it's embedded in me. So anyway, I ended up at University of Tennessee. I put myself through school. I worked as a bartender. After I became ineligible to play soccer, I jumped behind the bar and I worked at every good bar, quote unquote, good bar in Knoxville, Tennessee. So on Wednesdays, I worked one place. Thursdays, I worked a different place. Fridays, I worked a different place. Saturdays. So the good night, I basically like I would work at the, you know, like how like Thursdays are the best at Bar Knoxville. So I worked on Thursdays at Bar Knoxville. And then on Fridays, it's, you know, dollar drink night at the Gnome. So because I was such a good bartender, I was able to kind of command that. Like I basically demanded it. So I made really, really good money as a bartender. And luckily it was enough to, you know, keep me on my feet and keep me trucking through school. Graduated from college. As part of my story, I share often that I spent more nights than I care to admit sleeping in my car. More often than not, it was due to being like in between living arrangements. I had lived with multiple boyfriends, actually, college, kind of out of, looking back on it, kind of out of necessity. And when those relationships were no longer active relationships, the easier thing sometimes to do would be just to park on campus and sleep in my car. I'm not ashamed of it or embarrassed about it, but those nights, like being by myself, it's not the sleeping in my car thing, I think, that shaped me. It's the feeling of being completely and utterly on my own. Because I transferred colleges and I went to so many different high schools and I grew up, you know, across the freaking ocean and I'm just with all the kind of, I guess, turmoil of my upbringing, I have always had this feeling of like, I'm really all that I have. And it's a powerful, really, really powerful thing to have as part of your identity. Like I am very, very independent. I do things my way or the highway. I am fiercely loyal and driven, and I'm kind of a white knight when it comes to doing the right thing. And I think all of that boils down to my time working as a bartender, being behind the bar. Like there's no room for shenanigans when it comes to doing the right thing, like, you know, pocketing cash or getting caught sneaking a drink or, you know, anything like that. Like there's a lot of societal and also like literal legal responsibilities that you have as being a bartender in a weird way. And because I relied on that job so much and I relied on my reputation as being a very good bartender, keeping my nose as clean as possible was always the name of the game. And also because I was such a good bartender and because I was, you know, decent looking, I always have had an ex on my back. Like everywhere that I've gone, I've always had an ex on my back. Being the new girl in high school, being really good at sports, jumping in, and I'll never forget this, when I ended up graduating high school from a place called Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. If you've ever been there or heard of it, it's beautiful, it's amazing. But it was a cruel, weird place to go to high school because I transferred there my junior year of high school, I was immediately like hated on from every corner by every girl. And, you know, no one is perfect and I'm certainly not perfect, but it's just never lost on me the ex that I've had on my back. And I feel like I've been like blocking and defending against people that come for me. And I'm hedging what I'm saying because I don't want to come across as being like arrogant or having it be a flex or I don't know, whatever. But if you're smart and you're good at something, so I was really good at soccer and track and, you know, I'm smart and I know I'm smart and I, you know, have blonde hair and had a fit body. Like I know what that was as the quote unquote new girl. And I also know what that looked like from behind a bar in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I sure as shit use that to my advantage. So my point with this is sleeping in my car by myself late at night, unpacking, you know, what made me a good bartender, what made me a good student, and most importantly, what I wanted to do with my life. Like literally just like sitting there in the parking garage at University of Tennessee, just sitting with the current state of my life being so lonely, you know, not having any sort of friends from any of my worlds that were like consistent friends, the self-awareness factor that I developed by really just sitting in who I was, and also the comfortability factor that I developed in sitting with who I was during that time, it is what made me successful, really, really knowing who I am. And that started sleeping in my car in college. You know, the relationships that I had with various boys were fairly serious-ish relationships, but the relationship that I had with myself during that time was something that I wouldn't change for the world. And that the relationship that I had with myself really would appear when I was between relationships with boys. Between those relationships was really when my living arrangement would change because I lived with two of them. But when I would have to stay in my car, it just really forced me to sit with myself. So anyway, I graduated from college finally, scrapped my way through, got an amazing job working for a company called SunQuest, which is a medical software company. And I was selling big like capital equipment software, like big software installations to hospitals. So my clients were just a who's who list of hospital and hospital leadership. I think about this all the time. I do not know how I got that job out of college. I was applying for jobs everywhere. My degree was in German, which was not my preference. I have a German literature degree. Up until recently, like I've had such a deep chip on my shoulder about that degree because I worked so freaking hard to earn it. And my last semester of college, I was sitting with my advisor and she said, you know, my degree was supposed to be in international business. I thought that I was going to be this like big, bad corporate person. I was going to have this corporate identity. That's all that I wanted was I wanted to graduate from college. I wanted to get out from behind the bar. I wanted to get out from playing soccer. I wanted to have a stable career. And I knew that I was a leader. I was like, I'm going to be a Fortune 500 CEO. That's what I'm going to do. My goal and my dream was actually to go to law school. And I could not get a score on the LSAT to save my life to even be able to apply to schools. My grades were also in the absolute toilet, the various transfers and just getting by the skin of my teeth. And when it became evident that law school was out of the picture, I was dead convinced that I was going to be a Fortune 500 CEO if I just put my head down and worked. And I still stand by that. I think I am still going to be a Fortune 500 CEO. Like, I think that's still very much on the vision board and in the cards. Anyway, so I'm sitting with my advisor and my degree was supposed to be in international business. And she said, you know, you could graduate actually in December. So this was in October. She said, you could graduate in December with a German degree. Like, you have enough credits, like you have everything for a German, your degree will be in German literature. And I just remember going, fuck, you know, I do have an ego to some extent. And going from scrapping with all the accounting classes and the business classes that I had to take and ending up with a German literature degree, like that was a shot to my ego. And I don't really know why. Like, the classes that I really struggled with were those like accounting type classes or the classes where you really needed to know the material because I was trying so hard to graduate. So like those classes, it was really hard for me to pay attention in those classes. I'm also dyslexic. And so those classes like that were required for an international business degree, I just remember sitting there in her office and being like, come on, like I can't have German literature on my degree for the rest of my life. So having said all that, though, I am very passionate about German history and German literature. I am German. My dad's German. My grandparents grew up in Germany during World War II. I've always been really fascinated by that and by the Holocaust and like how that even happens, particularly from a leadership perspective. Like if I grew up in World War II, I think about it constantly. If I grew up in World War II Germany, would I have helped my Jewish neighbors? Would I have helped my Jewish friends? Like, what would that have looked like? Would I have been on board with like the Nazi Hitler like stuff that was happening? And how would I have reacted back then? Because I sure should know. Like now, if you know, in present day, I know how like fight or flight I am. Like I'm a fight kind of person from a leadership perspective. But anyway, I needed to find some kind of job before German literature hit my LinkedIn as like that's what my degree is. And so I applied to every kind of job, like every which way. My eye was on the prize though with medical sales. I graduated college in 2009. And during that time, medical sales was like the sexy thing, like working at Stryker or Eli Lilly, which I know is not medical sales, like that's like pharma, but like any of those like medical kind of fields were like the sexy thing, and making six figures was like my goal, my epic goal. Like I never wanted to make less than six figures graduating from college. And I promised myself that I would hustle my face off to make that happen. But also, you know, I'm applying to enterprise rent-a-car manager program and Chick-fil-A manager program in Atlanta, Georgia. But the job that I wanted so bad was at Sunquest Information Systems. It was medical software. This woman named Mary Vaughn, she worked in HR, interviewed me, and I hadn't even graduated college yet. And I remember in the interview with her, like I was just on one. Like I was vintage Holly Meyer Lucas on one, sold the absolute shit out of myself. Somehow she agreed to give me this job that I think about it nonstop. Like that job saved my life. I moved to Tucson. I flew out. That job saved my life, changed my life. It was the validation that I needed. It was like at that time I was struggling so much with like who I was and like what I was doing. I was in a relationship during that period of time too that was just so toxic when it came to my own confidence, my own like self-esteem. People describe me often as being like an alpha female type, and I'm actually not. I am a leader to my core. I'm a go-getter to my core. I'm driven to my core. But that alpha mentality of like needing to be the one in charge or like taking charge, that's actually not me. But I thought that because that was like the identity that society was kind of assigning to me, I thought that it made sense to be in a relationship with someone who was also like, I needed like a dude who was like, you know, super successful and driven and competitive and, you know, all of those things. And it's actually like the exact opposite. Like that type of personality, that like overbearing alpha tendency, competitive energy type personality is like the absolute, it's like kryptonite for my soul. Because what ends up happening when I have personalities like that is I'm going to stand down to that type of personality every time because duh, I'm smart. Like I'm not looking to go toe to toe with someone on like in the interest of the intensity of it and the passion around it. Like I actually always stand down in that type of a relationship. And it's interesting, like that type of personality, this person is a great guy. He's super smart. He's super successful and he's great. But only recently have I really like come to realize that actually when you have a personality like that, who's making you feel less than, you will only succumb to what you allow yourself to succumb to. Like I was allowing someone to treat me like that. And, you know, again, going back to like the self-awareness thing, like it's something that I learned so deeply about myself that like you allow people to treat you however you let them treat you. So him making me feel like, you know, I was just that I needed to be like so grateful to be in his orbit. That's my doing, you know, like it's, if you're listening to this and you have any kind of relationship like that, whether it be a boss or a boyfriend or a girlfriend or whatever, and they make you feel like you should be like grateful that you're doing that to yourself. So anyway, we broke up, so I got the job with Sunquest. That month, December of 2010 was like the month that changed my life. And I have these like moments of inflection in my life, but that changed my life. And it's funny, actually, the people that I worked for didn't even know what I was going through at the time. I flew out for training to Tucson, Arizona on December 4th. My birthday was December 5th. I celebrated my birthday basically like in, you know, without telling anyone or without like making it a thing. And I graduated December 10th, and I didn't walk at my graduation because I was in Tucson training. And this is funny. I just stayed in a hotel for 2 weeks when I was training with my boss, and I had to rent a car. When I got to Tucson, my boss told me to rent a car, that the reservation would be under my name, rent a car. They would set me up with an expense account, which was awesome. And you know, any kind of like, just keep any receipts, and then he'll show me how to submit it through Concur or whatever the expense system was. And so I land in Tucson, I go to rent the car, and I only have a debit card, you know, because I'm a college student basically. And they put a $200 hold on my debit card because I wasn't old enough, you know, for them to not do that. And that was the only money that I had. And so then I got to the hotel, and the hotel had to put, you know, for incidentals, they had to run it for $100, and that basically overdrew my bank account. So the entire week when I was in Tucson, Arizona, you know, training and learning the ropes and trying to pay attention, because it's really complicated. What I was doing in this corporate job was really complicated. It's hospital software and like it's the integration with the lab, and it's just a lot of training, a lot of things. And being someone who wasn't clinical, I had no clinical background whatsoever. I hadn't even really what's crazy is I hadn't even really I didn't really ever go to the doctor even. Like I had a bunch of stitches a lot from like playing sports and broken arms and all the things, but like I literally didn't know anything about the medical landscape. Nothing. I didn't understand how a hospital has a lab and radiology and the different departments. I didn't understand that at all. I digress. I spent that week, which was my birthday week too, but I was supposed to walk in my graduation on December 10th, but I didn't tell them that because I need.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
I did the job so bad. So I didn't tell them and I just stayed over the weekend and I didn't walk in my own college graduation. And I stayed with a completely overdrawn bank account. Every day that went by, my bank account was overdrawn. I was charged $33 from Wells Fargo every single day. So then by the end of the week, I had to check out of the hotel and they showed me how to submit my expenses through the Concur system. And at that point I had, you know, 2 weeks worth of hotel nights on my credit card. And the front desk of the hotel, the guy was so sweet. He basically told me like your card is declining. Like, you know, what's going on here? And I told him, I was like, I bartend, I don't have any money. I don't get paid by Sunquest until, you know, the next 2 weeks. Like, I don't know what to do. This guy, God bless him, he called the HR department at my job and basically like delicately told them that I was having an issue with my credit card and, you know, could they cover the bill? But man, it's looking back on it now, you know, as a leader, I would want my employee to tell me, this sounds ridiculous, but like that was a huge, huge, huge struggle. Anyway, that first job was everything to me. And I ended up working at Sunquest for 6 years. I was wildly successful, very, very good at the medical sales. My bosses were amazing. My teammates were amazing. I loved every little bit about it. So after that training, I flew back to Tennessee, which is, you know, where all my stuff was and and soon thereafter, the boyfriend that I mentioned and I broke up. And I, in the middle of the night, like the day that we broke up, I basically packed all my stuff and drove through the night to Atlanta, to move to Atlanta. I was living in Nashville. And at the time, like everything revolved around this boyfriend, like my entire life. And not really because I, you know, was so in love with him and my world was around him, but I didn't have family in the States. My family had moved back to Germany. I didn't have very good friends that were from college. I had spent my college years grinding to try to graduate. And so I didn't have a sphere of anything. And so I got in my car in the middle of the night and drove to Atlanta through the night, found an apartment basically on the way. Like on the way, I was just calling, you know, apartment buildings, trying to find somewhere to live. And I had my job at Sunquest, my good paying job. And I basically started my life over in Atlanta. And a couple weeks later, a girl that I went to college with was in town with one of my other friends. And she was dating and actually ended up married to this guy who played for the Braves. His name's Mike Minor. And she and I and our other friends went out to a bar in Atlanta where Mikey and his teammates were, who played for the Braves. And that's when I met my husband, who was with the Braves at the time. So that's how I met Ed. There's a whole funny story about how that happened. So anyway, I grinded in the corporate world, hustled my face off climbing the corporate ladder. If you knew me between 2010 and 2013, I loved the corporate world with every fiber of my being. I had my son, my oldest son, in 2013, and that kind of changed things because my husband was playing baseball at the time. He had just been called up to the big leagues, which was just absolutely amazing. I'll talk about him in maybe another episode. There's so much to unpack with him. He's just absolutely incredible. But my husband was playing baseball, so I had to take care of our son basically by myself during the season, and which is fun foreshadowing for my life. He still works in baseball. Baseball's a hell of a beast when it comes to family life and work-life balance and how to raise a family. When you work in professional sports, it's a lot. Like there's a lot that falls on the partner. I'll talk about that separately. maybe another time. But anyway, I was making it work with my oldest son. I would bring him to, if I had to travel, I would bring him with me sometimes and bring, like I would hire a sitter to come to the hotel room, like wherever I was working. Like I had to go to this conference in San Antonio, for example, and I found a babysitter in San Antonio to come to the hotel to watch him. And that trip, I'd done that a few times, and I was senior enough in my career at that point, and I was good enough at my job that I could get away with doing that kind of thing. I would go to my meetings and then I would travel with him home. And it wasn't great. It was actually like really hard. I hardly slept, and it wasn't, you know, good on him traveling constantly either. But I do think it's one of the reasons why Rhodes, my oldest son, is so easygoing is because I traveled a lot with him that first year of his life, you know, just getting after it in the corporate world. Like I knew no different. But there was a conference in San Antonio, and I'll never forget this. There was a conference in San Antonio where I brought him, I did my thing, finding a sitter. And the sitter ended up being very, very, very weird. Up until that point, I had gotten really lucky with finding sitters. I used a platform that the Miami Marlins put, the Miami Marlins family room put me in touch with. So every MLB team has a family office or a family room and a, what they call a wife wrangler. And there's typically a third party babysitting service that helps with the team for during the games. Anyway, that agency would always set me up in the cities that I would go to with a sitter that were like vetted and but there's no MLB team in San Antonio. So they didn't have anyone in San Antonio that they could set me up with. So I found someone on my own, and that person ended up just being really, really weird. And it was just weird vibes, bad vibes. And I had kind of a meltdown over like what I was doing. Like it became very obvious how absolutely insane it was to allow people to watch my kid so I could work in a city that I didn't know, that I didn't live in. And looking back on it, I cringe and like kind of shudder when I think about like all of the people that I let watch Rhodes under those circumstances. Luckily, everything was fine, but that incident in San Antonio really, really kicked my ass in terms of figuring out how to not do that anymore. My husband was with the Marlins at the time, so we were living in South Florida. We bought a house in Jupiter, Florida, had the most epic wherewithal and foresight to buy a house in 2014 in Jupiter. Now it would be so hard to be able to find the type of home that we were able to buy just because the housing market went nuts. And my biggest takeaway there is buy the house that you can afford now, like full stop, buy the house you can afford now. You will not lose money on real estate if it's the home that you're looking to live in with your family. Like I cannot emphasize that enough. So all of that serves as the backstory. My husband was still playing. We're now in 2015. That all serves as the backstory for me getting my real estate license. So I got pregnant with my second son in 2015, and I realized that I needed to figure out another career path. I loved my job in medical sales so much. I was so passionate about it. I loved it. I was good at it. But I couldn't travel for work anymore. And I remember this conversation so vividly where I was talking to my husband about like what I'm good at and what I can do. And I moved so much throughout my life. We had just bought the house in Jupiter. And I was like, the only thing I know how to do is sales and how to move and like how to like find a house in the next like city, wherever it is that we're moving to. And he was like, well, sounds like you're a real estate agent. And also that's the story that I've told so many times over and over again on stages and on, you know, podcasts and whatnot. Part of that is that real estate also represented the easiest way for me to get into a marketing career, actually. As a content creator in my soul, the thing that always spoke to me that I would always see with real estate agents is I would get postcards with their branding on it and like them branding and marketing themselves, like their personal brand. I would see their faces on buses. When I was living in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, there was a man, I talk about him a lot, John Butler. I reference him a lot. His daughter actually is a friend of mine. Her name's Emily Butler, and she's killing it right now. But her dad was like the guy in Coeur d'Alene when I was in high school. He, in terms of real estate, like he sold everything. His name was on everything. He owned the Century 21 brokerage, and John Butler was like the guy. And I just remember always thinking it was so cool how you can market yourself. In real estate, you're in charge of your own personal brand. You're in charge of your own destiny. And it's very similar to bartending, where when I needed money, when I was desperate, I knew for damn sure that if I jumped behind a bar, that I would make the most money. And I had to brand myself and market myself as the biggest, baddest bartender in town. And that's exactly what I did. And so real estate kind of represents the same opportunity, that if you can market yourself as being the best of the best, perception is reality, and you can set the tone for who you are and what you are kind of from day one. Now, is it totally appropriate to market yourself as the best of the best if you're not? Absolutely not. But you can set the tone with what type of real estate agent you are. You can set the tone with, like, real estate represents the lowest barrier to entry for a marketing career. And as a content creator, like, I didn't even know how much of a content creator I was. I didn't know how creative I actually was until I started selling real estate. So I'm pregnant with Brooks. I get my real estate license. This is in 2015. This is 10 years ago. And I hit the ground sprinting. My first year in real estate, despite having a baby, despite being by myself with Rhodes, despite my husband still playing baseball and, like, literally, like, me raising another baby by myself, having a newborn, my first year in real estate, I did like 80 sides. And a side is like a side of a transaction. And I started my team almost accidentally from day one. I went on a listing appointment. I started at Keller Williams and I went on a listing appointment. A seller called the office and no one else was in the office. So they gave me the opportunity to go and win this, like, seller, you know, seller wanted to sell their house. So I go on this listing appointment and I accidentally talked in terms of we. Like, I kept saying, well, we're going to do this and we're going to do this. And the seller hired me, but I had no we. So I got back to the Keller Williams office and I was like, there was a girl in the office, her name was Savannah, and she was amazing. She was 19 at the time, so she couldn't even buy the champagne to buy as a closing gift, but she was in the office and I was like, what are you doing? Do you want to join my team? And she graciously did. She was my first agent. She's absolutely amazing. She still crushes it. We actually are doing a deal with her right now. She's with another team. I learned so much about leadership and about real estate and about branding and marketing. I think about those days all the time. Like, I was just kind of flying by the seat of my pants, just trying to figure it out. But one thing was for sure, and that is that I was really, really, really good at selling real estate. Like I said, I did 80 sides. A lot of those were rentals for my friends in the baseball world. So I immediately rose to stardom, if you will, in the real estate space by selling a handful of homes to some pretty famous people. And so I was in the news in terms of, like, being like the celebrity realtor pretty early on. I also had a real edge with being the baseball realtor because my first year doing these spring training rentals for my baseball friends who come to Jupiter, Florida for spring training. So the Cardinals are here, the Miami Marlins, the Washington Nationals, the Astros and the Mets are all here. So if you're with one of those teams as a player, you need a spring training rental. And so my first year in real estate, I did the rentals for, like, every superstar that you can imagine with those teams, like, literally Strasburg, Wainwright, Mattingly, Giancarlo Stanton, Yelich, Real Muto, Bregman, Scherzer. If they were a superstar, I was doing their spring training rental, which was really cool. But also the pressure that it put on me, my first couple of years in real estate to deliver these spring training rentals was, like, out of this world, but it put me on the map too. A lot of those guys ended up buying houses and I was able to represent them as their real estate agent, which totally put me on the map. But what I learned throughout that process of just being on a rocket ship to the moon, you know, I would sell one house to a baseball player and then all of a sudden five people in the neighborhood wanted to list their home with me because the one baseball player is what made the news, which was awesome. But also what put me on the map was my marketing and my marketing of the team and legging out the PR. So when I say that I got in the news because of, you know, my celebrity clients, quote unquote, it wasn't me planting those stories by any stretch of the imagination. I've never done that unless I've been asked to by the client, actually, which has happened a handful of times. But it's always me saying no comment because something has ended up in the news, but then making sure that if it's appropriate, like if it's a news story that's worth sharing on social media, I've always been really good about legging out the PR as one does and as one needs to do when you own a business. With the exception of the stories where a celebrity client's address has been posted or a story about them buying a house has been shared that they absolutely don't want in the public, I'm extraordinarily respectful about when that happens. Like, they find these stories from the public records, but I'm really respectful about not legging out, like, that PR. For example, one of the first news stories that I was on, a journalist called me about spring training rentals and, like, the shortage of spring training rentals because I had posted something on Facebook saying that I needed spring training rentals for my clients. They're, you know, baseball players. And he saw it and reached out to me to do a story on it. And I turned that news clip into a multi-million dollar business. So the passion that came out of that, not just PR, but the connective tissue all around your personal brand, all around marketing, the end-to-endness of PR, social media, marketing, messaging, and then the service that you deliver creating an end-to-end solution for all of that is something that I have always been deeply, deeply passionate about. It's something that I've always been extremely good at. I'm very creative. From day one with my real estate business, I was creating all kinds of events and initiatives and community-focused things. And that is really what our secret sauce was as a real estate company. I knew early on that creating a founder story and a story around who we are and like marketing the, my agents and my team first and foremost over our homes was going to win us more business and was going to put us on the map and make us relevant. My team became kind of its own little reality show by accident on social media. And when I say by accident, the point of me putting out our content on social media wasn't, you know, at the time it wasn't done. Like short form video was not a thing. Was I posting video? Absolutely I was. Was I sharing all the pictures of us at events? Like I would make it like almost like a requirement as being part of my team to show up at events and be like together and social. And buyers and sellers came to us in droves because they wanted to be friends with us. And the reason they wanted to be friends with us was because the messaging and the branding and the marketing that I put out on the airwaves on social media and on our mailers and on every bit of marketing that I could, the vibe was that we're a fun team. We are connected. We hang out together. We work with some awesome people. And you want to work with us because you want to be friends with us. And that is now, where I'm recording this in 2025, that is now arguably the most brilliant thing that you can do in marketing. And at the time, I did that because I knew how it worked in the bar scene. When I was bartending in college, one of the things that I could always count on is people showing up to, if the cool kids on campus showed up somewhere, the rest of the campus would follow. And usually the cool kids were the athletes or the hot chicks. So if you could get the athletes and the hot chicks to show up for you and then make it seem like they're having fun, which is the trick, making it seem like they're having fun. Well, how do you make it seem like they're having fun? You share pictures on the bar's Facebook page. You tag them in the pictures, the cool kids, and then their friends see it. And so that logic applies to, I mean, that it literally is beginner level, basic bitch level influencer marketing. And at the time I was doing that for the bars because I had a vested interest in people showing up. Like I needed to make money. I needed Bar Knoxville to be hopping on Thursdays because that's where I was working. And so I would take over the bar's social media pages and I would be tagging the athletes and the hot chicks and strategically making sure that they ended up in pictures together so that I could post them and tag them so that they would show up on social media in the same picture and then make the rest of campus want to show up there. Low key brilliant. But now it's like the most basic thing ever. Anyway, I applied the same logic to my real estate business where I would tag my agents and things intentionally to demonstrate to the rest of the community that we were showing up and showing out. And we did a ton of other things too. Like we, back in the day, like when I go back and look, I mean, there's so many amazing things that we did for the community. And one of the smartest things that I ever did was I told my brokerage at the time that I needed an external office. We'd outgrown our space at Keller Williams. We were like on a rocket ship to the moon. I had a corner office before I knew it. And we had outgrown that before I knew what's what. This was all within like the first year. And I needed a space. It was deeply important to me that I had a physical space for my team that I owned, not owned literally, but that was like my space, my lease, my furniture, my vibe, meaning my teams, because we were, like I said, we were like a reality show. Like I was putting out so much content around the team. And the only way for me to really achieve that was if I had my own physical space where we worked out of. So at this point, I had a team of around 10 agents, and it was really important that the brand of the Meyer Lucas team with the lemons and the neon and all the fun things, all the emojis, like every single thing that I did was with the intention of us seeming like we were fun and putting out the brand to make people want to hire us because it looked like we were having fun. And by the way, we did have fun. It was those years were some of the most fun memories for me with the team because I was pouring so many resources and money into what we were doing marketing wise and taking care of so much of the team. And I was just being the most epic yes man. So when I look back on it, and I'll talk about how everything turned toxic in a second. There was a major turning point in 2020 when things just really, really got weird and toxic. And all of it was because I was so focused on building the brand and building, you know, finding the next sale and hiring people who were a good fit personality-wise, who I wanted to work with, who seemed like they were fun, but had no business being in the position that I hired them for. And so I would try to create a different position for them, or I'd like shift them. I had no job descriptions for anyone. I had people who were just taking such epic advantage of me. I was overpaying for talent who, if I'm being totally honest, just really sucked at their jobs. And I was doing everything. Like, I was literally doing everything. I lived in this hell of like, never mind, I'll just do it. Never mind, I'll just do it. Never mind, I'll just do it. Because I couldn't hold anyone accountable to the jobs that I needed them to do. And a lot of that has to do with us as a company leveling up so fast and growing so fast that I really needed quality talent kind of immediately. And instead, I found people who were great personality fits, who were, you know, had never had, like many of them had never had like a real job before, or they were, you know, career transitioning and they really needed development around like business type things. And I just didn't have the time to slow down to train them. So instead I would just create another role for them, or I would shift them around, or one of the people actually that I hired who was actually a pretty good fit for her, I had to let go because she was just like lying to everyone about a lot of things. Like, she was kind of a compulsive liar. And I'll never forget this. Like, I let it go on for like a month, like knowing full well that she was spreading weird lies about, like, she would do this thing where she made it seem like she was working a lot harder than she was. And I caught her in it a handful of times where, for example, I had a trip planned to go see my husband. He had retired from playing, and then he was coaching with the Miami Marlins. He was their video replay guy in the big league. So he was traveling with the big league team, and they were playing against the Giants in the Bay Area. And I had a trip planned to go and visit him on the road. I love San Francisco. I love visiting him on the road. My kids were being watched by my mom, and I was going to go fly out to meet him in San Francisco. And we were going to have a nice little weekend. And this employee told me up and down that, you know, she had everything covered and that everything was fine and I should go. And that she, you know, was great and she was prepared and whatnot. And then I caught her saying to the team, like in a team meeting, that I sprung the trip on her and that I put it on her plate and that she doesn't know what to do with, you know, this thing and that thing. And like, and in the meeting, she said, well, you guys know Holly. And collectively, and I know this because it was like a streamed meeting by accident, so I like could see everything. And collectively the room went, oh yeah, no, like everyone like agreed with it. And it made me take this real step back as a leader that like, that I was putting out into the universe that like I was doing things kind of like willy-nilly by the seat of my pants. And at that point this was 4 years into the team. And it just made me like really realize that the leader that I had become, or the character that I was playing as a leader, was not aligned with how I actually am. Like, I had branded myself as being like fun uncle basically. And like that I basically was making myself smaller to accommodate everyone around me. Like, if someone wasn't great at their job, meaning, you know, if someone was failing in a certain area, I would create a new role for them, and I would be fun uncle who like, you know, would empower them to stay within the team, but in a different role. And then I would just wear the hat that they were supposed to be of the role that they were supposed to be doing. Or if an agent, you know, was working with one of our buyers, and I really needed that agent to step up to the plate and like work with the buyer, but the buyer didn't want to work with them because they were, you know, mediocre, I would make the excuses for them. I was just such a yes man, and I wanted people to like me, and I wanted my agents to like me. And so I would like literally lie to my agents and say, like, if, for example, if a seller called the office and said, hey, I want to list my house, and I would give it to agent, let's call her Annie. I would give the listing opportunity to Annie and say, okay, go on this listing appointment, like, let's win it, you know, whatever. Then the seller would call back after meeting with Annie and say like, oh yeah, I have no confidence that Annie knows what she's doing. I need to work with you, meaning Holly. That would always put me in a really tough position to have to tell Annie that like, I tried to give her an opportunity, but the seller only wants me. And this is a really common problem to have in real estate. But the hole that I dug myself into was I would lie to Annie and I would say that, no, he, you know, I'm going to keep this one. I'll still pay you. So I would still cut these agents in on their like commission split, but I would like say like, or wouldn't even say anything. Like, I would just step in and take over and, you know, seeming then like a micromanager, even though the seller, you know, called and said that they only want to work with me, but I wouldn't have the heart to tell Annie why, you know, that the seller wasn't confident that she knew what she was doing. And I had a girl in particular that worked with my professional athletes. I paid her weekly to help working with the professional athletes that I had for their spring training rentals. So I was doing so many spring training rentals at that time. And as I mentioned, you know, I was working with a who's who of people, like very high stakes people who had agents and financial advisors, and they had a whole teams of people who are very brilliant, very, very high achieving type people. If you've watched Entourage, and you can imagine Ari Gold on the other end of the phone sending his athlete client to Jupiter, Florida for spring training rental, like he expects a lot. And this girl that I had running point with those, the feedback that I got from my agent contacts and from the athletes themselves and from their financial advisors was consistently and constantly negative. Like they had no confidence that she could handle their client, because she was very meek and mild and very like she came across as very weak. And I tried working with her a little bit on it and tried coaching her on like how to, you know, have more gift of gab and how to, you know, take control of certain, you know, situations. Like we would do like situational type training. And the thing that was missing from the puzzle there is that I would basically go like halfway through, I'd follow through halfway in training her and in working with her and being her leader. And then about halfway through, when I needed to deliver the message to her that the feedback is that you come across as weak, or that you don't know what you're doing, or that you're not in control of the client, or that the client has lost confidence in your ability to deliver for their high stakes client. Instead of me being able to say that to her, I would pretend like we were doing some kind of like professional development thing and not have the tough conversation over and over and over again. And so when things came to a head in 2020, we were running a million miles an hour. Like I was running and gunning real estate all over Palm Beach County. I was, you know, the I feel like it's a cartoon where it's like a ship and there are holes in the hull, and Bugs Bunny is like running through, like just patching up the holes, like holding up the holes with every single, with his palm, like up against the hull of the, you know, where the water is seeping in. And that's how I was. I was treading water, barely. I was barely getting by. And in 2020, as everyone remembers, the pandemic, you know, caused 2019 was really when the housing market just got absolutely bananarama. And then in 2020, things kicked into high gear with the pandemic. I was pregnant with my third baby. I had my third baby in May of 2020. And 2 weeks later, a life-changing moment happened. And I'm going to stop right there. I've been recording now for an hour. I'm going to stop right there. And I'm going to say that if you want to listen to part two incoming. But if you've made it this far, thank you for your time. Thank you for your attention. If anything, if I end up not even sharing this, if anything, telling my story and getting the opportunity to do that here for the first time in 10 years, feels good. Like it feels really, really good to tell things how they were, uninterrupted and in my own way. So thank you for your attention. I sincerely hope that something that I share as part of this podcast, something that I share along the way, provides value to you in a way that helps you make a decision, that helps you, that inspires you, that helps you make the pivot that you're needing to do, or I hope that you can learn from something that I share and eke out some value here. So anyway, part two coming up.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.